Welcome to the Sagebrush Trail. Stories of adventure in the Old West, from the frontier to the Yukon. I'm Mardell, reading The Virginian by Owen Wister. Chapter 13, The Game and the Nation, Act First. There can be no doubt of this. All America is divided into two classes, the quality and the equality. The latter will always recognize the former. When mistaken for it, both will be with us until our women bear nothing but kings. It was through the Declaration of Independence that we Americans acknowledged the eternal inequality of man, for by it we abolished a cut-and-dried aristocracy. We had seen little men artificially held up in high places, and great men artificially held down in low places, and our own justice-loving hearts abhorred this violence to human nature. Therefore we decreed that every man should thenceforth have equal liberty to find his own level. By this very decree we acknowledged and gave freedom to true aristocracy, saying, "Let the best man win, whoever he is. Let the best man win." That is America's word. That is true democracy. And true democracy and true aristocracy are one and the same thing. If anybody cannot see this, so much the worse for his eyesight. The above reflections occurred to me before reaching Billings, Montana, some 3 weeks after I had unexpectedly met the Virginian at Omaha, Nebraska. I had not known of that trust given to him by Judge Henry, which was taking him east. I was looking to ride with him before long among the clean hills of Sunk Creek. I supposed he was there. But I came upon him one morning in Colonel Cyrus Jones' eating palace. Did you know the palace? It stood in Omaha near the trains, and it was 10 years old, which is middle-aged in Omaha, when I first saw it. It was a shell of wood, painted with golden emblems, the steamboat, the eagle, the Yosemite, and a live bear ate gratuities at its entrance. Weather permitting, it opened upon the world as a stage upon the audience. You sat in Omaha's whole sight and dined, while Omaha's dust came and settled upon the refreshments. It has gone the way of the Indian and the buffalo, for the West is growing old. You should have seen the palace and sat there. In front of you passed rainbows of men, Chinese, Indian chiefs, Africans, General Miles, younger sons, Austrian nobility, wide females in pink. Our continent drained prismatically through Omaha once. So I was passing that way also, walking for the sake of ventilation from a sleeping car toward a bath, when the language of Colonel Cyrus Jones came out to me, the actual colonel I had never seen before. He stood at the rear of his palace in gray flowery mustaches and a Confederate uniform, telling the wishes of his guests to the cook through a hole. You always bought meal tickets at once, else you became unwelcome. Guests here had foibles at times, and a rapid exit was too easy. Therefore, I bought a ticket. It was spring and summer since I had heard anything like the colonel. The Missouri had not yet flowed into New York dialect freely, and his vocabulary met me like the breeze of the plains. So I went in to be fanned by it, and there sat the Virginian at a table alone. His greeting was up to the code of indifference proper on the plains, but he presently remarked, "I'm right glad to see somebody," which was a good deal to say. "Them that comes here," he observed next, "don't eat, they feed." And he considered the guests with a somber attention. "Do you reckon they find joyful digestion in this swallow and get-out drough?" "What are you doing here, then?" said I. Oh, pshaw, when you can't have what you choose, you just choose what you have. And he took the bill of fare. I began to know that he had something on his mind, so I did not trouble him further. Meanwhile, he sat studying the bill of fare. Ever heard of them? He inquired, shoving me the spotted document. Most improbable dishes were there. Salmis, canapes, supremes, all perfectly spelt and absolutely transparent. It was the old trick of copying some metropolitan menu to catch travelers of the third and last dimension of innocence. And whenever this is done, the food is of the third and last dimension of awfulness, which the cowpuncher knew as well as anybody. So they keep that up here still, I said. But what about them? He repeated. His finger was at a special item, frog legs, La Delmonico. Are they true anywheres? He asked. And I told him certainly. I also explained to him about Delmonico of New York and about Augustin of Philadelphia. There's not a little bit of use in lying to me this morning, he said with his engaging smile. I ain't gonna order anything's legs. Well, I'll see how he gets out of it, I said, remembering the odd Texas legend. The traveler read the bill of fare, you know. It called for vol-au-vent, and the proprietor looked at the traveler and, running a pistol in his ear, observed, you'll take hash. I was thinking of this and wondering what would happen to me, so I took the step. Wants frog legs, does he? Shouted Colonel Cyrus Jones. He fixed his eye upon me and it narrowed to a slit. Too many brain workers breakfastin' before you came in, Professor, said he. Missionary ate the last leg off me just now. Brown the wheat, he commanded through the hole to the cook, for someone had ordered hot cakes. I'll have fried eggs, said the Virginian. Cook both sides. White wings, sang the colonel through the hole. Let 'em fly up and down. Coffee and no milk, said the Virginian. Draw one in the dark, the colonel roared. And beefsteak rare. One slaughter in the pan and let the blood drip. I should like a glass of water, please, said I. The colonel threw me a look of pity. One Missourian ice for the professor, he said. That fellow's a right live man, commented the Virginian, but he seemed thoughtful. Presently he inquired, you say he was a foreigner and learned fancy cooking to New York? That was this cowpuncher's way. Scarcely ever would he let drop a thing new to him until he had got from you your whole information about it. So I told him the history of Lorenzo Delmonico and his pioneer work as much as I knew, and the Southerner listened intently. Mighty interesting, he said, mighty. He could just take little old ordinary frogs and dandy 'em up to suit the bloods. Mighty interesting, I expect, though his cooking would give an outraged stomach to a plain-raised man. If you want to follow it up, said I, by way of a sudden experiment, Miss Molly Wood might have some book about French dishes. But the Virginian did not turn a hair. I reckon she wouldn't, he answered. She was raised in Vermont. They don't bother overly about their eatin' up in Vermont. Here's what Miss Wood recommended the last time I was seeing her, the cowpuncher added, bringing Kenilworth from his pocket. Right fine story. That Queen Elizabeth must have certainly been a competent woman. She was, said I, but talk came to an end here. A dusty crew, most evidently from the plains, now entered and drifted to a table, and each man of them gave the Virginian about a quarter of a slouchy nod. His greeting to them was very serene. Only Kenilworth went back into his pocket, and he breakfasted in silence. Among those who had greeted him, I now recognized a face. Why, that's the man you played cards with at Medicine Bow, I said. Yes, Trampas. He's got a job at the ranch now. The Virginian said no more, but went on with his breakfast. His appearance was changed, Aged, I would scarcely say, for this would seem as if he did not look young. But I think that the boy was altogether gone from his face, the boy whose freak with Steve had turned Medicine Bow upside down, whose other freak with the babies had outraged Bear Creek, the boy who had loved to jingle his spurs. But manhood had only trained, not broken, his youth. It was all there, only obedient to the rein and curb. Presently we went together to the railway yard. "The judge is doing right smart of business this year," he began, very casual indeed, so that I knew this was important. Besides bells and coal smoke, the smell and crowded sounds of cattle rose in the air around us. "Is our first gather of beeves on the ranch," continued the Virginian. "The whole lot shipped through to Chicago in two sections over the Burlington. The judge is fighting the Elkhorn Road." We passed slowly along the two trains. 20 cars, each car packed with huddled, round-eyed, gazing steers. He examined to see if any animals were down. "They ain't ate or drank nothing to speak of," he said, while the terrified brutes stared at us through their slats. "Not since they struck the railroad they've not drank. You might suppose they know somehow what they're traveling to Chicago for." And casually, always casually, he told me the rest. Judge Henry could not spare his foreman away from the second gather of beeves. Therefore, these two 10-car trains, with their double crew of cowboys, had been given to the Virginian's charge. After Chicago, he was to return by St. Paul over the Northern Pacific, for the judge had wished him to see certain of the road's directors and explain to them persuasively how good a thing it would be for them to allow especially cheap rates to the Sunk Creek outfit henceforth. This was all the Virginian told me, and it contained the whole matter, to be sure. "So you're acting foreman," said I. "Why, somebody has to have the say, I reckon." "And of course you hated the promotion?" "I don't know about promotion," he replied. "The boys have been used to seeing me as one of themselves. Why don't you come along with us as far as Plattsmouth?" Thus he shifted the subject from himself, and called to my notice the locomotives backing up to his cars, and reminded me that from Plattsmouth I had the choice of two trains returning. But he could not hide or belittle this confidence of his employer in him. It was the care of several thousand perishable dollars, and the control of men. It was a compliment. There were more steers than men to be responsible for, but none of the steers had been suddenly picked from the herd and set above his fellows. Moreover, Chicago finished up the steers, but the new-made deputy foreman had then to lead his six highly unoccupied brethren away from towns and back to peace to the ranch, or disappoint the judge, who needed their services. These things sometimes go wrong in a land where they say you are all born equal. And that quarter of a nod in Colonel Cyrus Jones' eating palace held more equality than any whole nod you could see. But the Virginian did not see it, there being a time for all things. We trundled down the flopping, heavy-eddied Missouri to Plattsmouth, and there they backed us onto a siding, the Christian Endeavor being expected to pass that way. And while the equality absorbed themselves in a deep but harmless game of poker by the side of the railway line, the Virginian and I sat on the top of a car, contemplating the sandy shallows of the Platte. "I should think you'd take a hand," said I. "Poker? For them kittens?" One flash of the inner man lighted in his eyes and died away, and he finished with his gentle drawl, "When I play, I want it to be interesting." He took out Sir Walter's Kenilworth once more and turned the volume over and over slowly without opening it. You cannot tell if in spirit he wandered on Bear Creek with the girl whose book it was. The spirit will go one road and the thought another, and the body its own way sometimes. "Queen Elizabeth would have played a mighty powerful game," was his next remark. Poker? Said I. Yes, sir. Do you expect Europe has gotten a queen equal to her at present? I doubted it. Victoria'd get pretty nice slain sliding ships out against Elizabeth. Only most probably, Victoria, she'd insist on a half-cent limit. You've read this here, Kenilworth? Well, deal Elizabeth ace high, and she could scare Robert Dudley with a full house plumb out of the betting.
I said that I believe she unquestionably could.
And, said the Virginian, if Essex play got next her too near, I reckon she'd have stacked the cards. Say, do you remember Shakespeare's fat man?
Falstaff? Oh, yes, indeed. Ain't that grand? Why, he makes men talk the way they do in life.
I reckon he couldn't get printed today. It's a right down shame Shakespeare couldn't know about poker. He'd have had Falstaff playing all day at that tear sheet outfit. And the prince would have beat him.
The prince had brains, said I.
Brains? Well, didn't he?
I never thought to notice. Like as not he did.
And Falstaff didn't, I suppose. Oh, yes, sir. Falstaff could have played whist.
I suppose you know what you're talking about. I don't, said I, for he was drawling again. The cowpuncher's eye rested a moment amiably upon me.
You can play whist with your brains, he mused, brains and cards. Now, cards are only one of the manifestations of poker in this here world, one of the shapes you fool with it in when the day's work is over. If a man is built like that prince boy was built, and it way down deep beyond brains, he'll play the winning poker with whatever hand he's holding when the trouble begins. Maybe it will be a mean, trifling army, or an empty six-shooter, or a lame hoss, or maybe just nothing but his natural countenance. Most any old thing'll do for a fellow like that prince boy to play poker with.
Then I'd be grateful for your definition of poker, said I. Again, the Virginian looked over at me amiably.
You put up a mighty pretty game of whist yourself, he remarked. Don't that give you the contented spirit?
And before I had any reply to this, the Christian Endeavor began to come over the bridge. Three installments crossed the Missouri from Pacific Junction, bound for Pike's Peak, every car swathed in bright bunting, and at each window a Christian with a handkerchief joyously shrieking. Then the cattle trains got the open signal, and I jumped off.
"Tell the judge the steers was all right this far," said the Virginian.
That was the last of the deputy foreman for a while. Join me next week on the Sagebrush Trail for another exciting chapter of The Virginian by Owen Wister.